Well, let's get into our sermon time for this morning. And, we started this sermon series we've been doing on Sunday mornings on the Gospel of Luke back in April, back when we weren't meeting, and I was just recording myself over in the powerhouse for you. But the first couple of sermons that we had in this series focused on awe and wonder. I don't know if you'll remember that. It was the awe and wonder that the priest Zechariah felt when an angel showed up and told him that he was going to be he and his wife would give birth to a child who would end up being the herald for the Messiah that Israel had been waiting for centuries. So a moment of awe and wonder and butterflies and excitement for Zechariah there. And of course, a very similar awe and wonder experienced by a young woman named Mary when that same angel came to her and said she was actually going to give birth to that Messiah. Incredible stuff. Of course, there was awe and wonder to go around on a hillside in Bethlehem the night that baby was actually born. And there was awe and wonder in the hearts of the elderly God followers, Simeon and Anna, who were alerted by the Holy Spirit to the significance of Jesus' birth and who got to see that baby and touch him and bless him before they would pass on out of this world. So things they had longed to see, awe and wonder at the acts of God in the world, God at work. Well, I want to bring us back to this idea of awe and wonder today, although we're going to kind of come at it from quite a different angle, a different direction than in that earlier sermon. This is going to be a different type of sermon today, not as Bible-centric as we almost always are, but I do think the topics we'll cover today are good for Christians to cover. I do this here from time to time. And my hope is that the words and thoughts I'll relay to you today will help you capture some of that awe and wonder of God for yourself. Launching point for my sermon this morning is going to come from two verses in Luke chapter 12, two great verses that are well known by Christians, but they are verses we skipped past last Sunday, and we certainly don't want to miss them altogether, so we're going to bring them out today. So here I'll have on the board for you is my central, very short passage for us in our sermon for the day. Luke 12, verses 6 to 7, where Jesus said, "Are not five sparrows sold for two pennies? Yet not one of them is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Don't be afraid, you're worth more than many sparrows." So some great comforting teaching from Jesus there. Have you ever wondered if it's true? Have you ever wondered if God actually knows the number of hairs on your head? I mean, that's kind of that's an always changing number, isn't it? Aren't we losing some? And John saying his is easy to count. But for most of us, right, we're losing hairs all the time. We're growing them back. I mean, how do you keep track of this stuff? That'd be a hard number to determine and keep on top of as it changes over time. Maybe I should say as it recedes over time. So can God really keep track of that? I mean, how many heads of hair are there on this planet? 7.5 billion? That's a lot of hair. Wow. It's a similar question to maybe another one that you have asked in your past. Is it actually possible that God hears my prayers? He knows my prayers? A lot of people on this planet praying. I mean, not all 7.5 billion know the correct God to pray to, but I would guess that every one of us has prayed something out to the divine, right? Made requests of God regularly. So that is a lot of prayers. Can God really handle billions of prayers? It seems like too many. Well, years ago, Jim Carrey starred in a movie called Bruce Almighty, and the idea of the movie was that at one point, Bruce complained to God about how he was doing his job, and so God comes to Bruce and says, well, you know, why don't you just take a moment to be in my shoes? You do it for a while. And so Bruce is given all the powers of the Almighty. And if you've seen that movie, my question about whether or not God can handle billions of prayers may have already brought this scene to your mind. Let's watch it together here.
Prayers, okay, prayers.
This creepy whisper thing has to
end. Organization and management is what I need. I need a system, something concrete. Concentrate.
Files. Let all prayers be organized into files.
Well, that takes care of the voices. Not exactly a space saver, though.
Grace might notice.
I know. Prayer post-its! Okay, I need something with a lock. Security, combination, password. Password. We bless, no mess. Downloading now.
It's good.
It's good.
This is gonna take a while.
$1,527,503 prayer requests.
I better manifest some coffee.
All right, so there's that clip, and then as the scene goes on, Bruce goes into hyperspeed to answer all those prayers, but by the time he gets done, he discovers there's another $3.5 million that have come in that in the time it took him to answer that first batch. So, you know, kind of fanciful movie stuff there, but it is an interesting thing to think about, how the real God can handle the huge number of prayers that come to him every minute of every day. So a teaching from Jesus that says that God knows the number of hairs on our head, I would think definitely implies to us that he also knows our prayers, right? Well, that's a lot of prayers for him to listen to and be aware of. Can God really do that? Well, friends, here is where we need to let the awe and wonder of God start to kick in. Anna and I have a crabapple tree in our backyard, and we love it for three seasons of the year. Fall is the one season where we don't love it because things actually do fall from that tree, namely hundreds and hundreds of crab apples, and we get to rake, and then we get to rake again, and then we get to dodge the bees that love those little rotting pieces of fruit, and we go rake some more. Other three seasons, that tree is great, and especially it is great in the spring when that tree is in its flowering phase. Seems like it varies a little bit from year to year. We didn't get as many flowers this past spring, but the spring before last was by far the most that we had ever had on that tree. I mean, the entire tree was covered with these little pink flowers, and seriously, you would have had to had a pretty hard heart to not have looked at that tree and thought, man, that thing is beautiful, right? If you took the time to look at it. Well, the fact that we lived there made it pretty hard not to notice, and so a couple of those days when that tree was in full bloom that year, warm days, I put a chair out in the backyard, and I would just have my coffee, and I'd just sit there and stare up. I'd be underneath the tree. I'd just stare up and look at that stuff and just thank God for it. It was amazing and incredible. So one of those times, as I'm sitting there, I started counting. So the flowers form in clumps, more or less, and you know, they're all over the branches. And if I remember right, I think that I estimated that there might be 40 of those little flowers in one clump. I guess that there was an average of 15 of those clumps on any given, you know, a typical branch. And I was estimating also that there probably were about 80 to 100 flowering branches on our tree. So we'll use 90 for the math that I'm about to do for you. So if you have 40 flowers in a clump, and you multiply that by 15 clumps on a branch, and you take that times 90 flowering branches, that would mean there were 54,000 little pink flowers on our tree in our backyard. 54,000. And I'm thinking that's probably relatively close to being accurate. So as I sat in my chair in the backyard that spring day, my flower counting got me to thinking that God is a God of absolutely huge numbers. This is just one tree. How many crabapple trees are there in the world, right? So how many little pink flowers celebrate their creator every spring? And each of those flowers, all 54,000 of them on our tree, has intricate detail and beauty just by itself. So it's not just in the overall picture that you see beauty there, but in the minute detail as well. Beauty, design, function, awesome stuff. And that's not the last time I'm going to say awesome today. Okay. Well, counting crabapple tree flowers really is just scratching the surface when it comes to considering the immense numbers of things that God has created in our world and in our universe. And I'll just throw a few stats out to you here because we've done this kind of thing here before. But speaking of sitting in your backyard and looking up, how many of you have done that in the past and wondered how many stars are out there in the night sky? Well, astronomers tell us that there are an estimated 100,000 million stars. Okay, so that, I guess that's 1 million stars 100,000 times. And that's just in the Milky Way galaxy alone. There are, I am told, millions of other galaxies out there as well besides our galaxy. That's a pretty big number of stars. A little closer to home, I asked my computer yesterday how many fish are in the planet's oceans. And I got an answer that I don't even know how to say to you. Here it is. There are estimated to be 3,500,000,000,000,000,000 fish. And the computer followed that number with the comment that counting the number of fish is a daunting and near impossible task. Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. Hey, we know that everything on our planet is made up of atoms, each containing, you know, electrons and a nucleus of protons and neutrons. So how about this question then? How many atoms are in one human being? Answer, an adult is made up of around 7 octillion atoms. That is a lot more zeros there than in the number that represented how many fish are in the sea. And really, you have to ask yourself then, don't you? Okay, if there are 7 octillion atoms in one human body, how many atoms are there on the planet total? How many atoms are there in the universe? You got to ask, and of course you know that we will never get to an answer, and even if we could, our brains wouldn't comprehend it. Well, you know what this tells me? This tells me that our Creator is very comfortable dealing in absolutely huge numbers. This is the universe Yahweh created. He deals in the immense, and he deals in the intricate, beautiful details of individual little pink flowers. The pattern of the wings, the pattern on the wings of a single ladybug. The stunning construction of individual tiny snowflakes. Not to mention the protons and electrons that, you know, make up all of those things. We're singing the hymn, Great is Thy Faithfulness, at the end of today's service, but it's too bad we're not repeating one we did a couple of weeks ago. How great thou art! How great thou art, Lord God. That's incredible. And then I want to emphasize to you also this morning that these things, you know what, they did for sure come about by the hands of a creator, not by some mindless, unconscious evolutionary force. You know, don't get me wrong, I do think there are some things to commend the concept of natural selection as a possible explanation for how God brings about some of the changing diversity that we see in the natural world. But natural selection by itself just cannot be the overall explanation of life on this planet, and I want to talk about that a little bit here today. This next section of my sermon got inspired because I watched a Planet Earth special this week. And there was one part in it, especially, that got my mind moving on this stuff. So let me explain it to you. Here is a picture of a goby fish. Goby fish are found all over the world, most commonly in tropical areas. They're bottom dwellers that have a little suction cup on their bellies between two of their fins that help them move about on the ocean floor. Gobies usually are no more than 4 inches long. So the show, Planet Earth show I was watching was on Hawaii, the nature in Hawaii. And the part of it that got my mind going was actually the show's section on the goby fish. So the goby fish living in the ocean around the Hawaiian Islands, at some point in their past, discovered that the calm pools and the rivers on these islands were a great place for them not only to survive, but to thrive. Okay, there were fewer predators in those rivers than in the open ocean, and there was plenty of food. So they continued to spawn in the ocean and spend some time there, but then after their first few months, they would go back to the rivers and spend the rest of their time in the rivers. So one problem developed, as I understand it. You learn a lot from watching these shows. So the Hawaiian Islands, I learned from watching this, were all at one point growing islands because of volcanic activity beneath them. Only the main island now sits over this occasionally active volcanic area. But lava would spew out occasionally and then harden and make these islands bigger over time. And so, and this is my understanding now from what I watched, this meant that these rivers that the gobies had become accustomed to using started coming down from higher heights over time as the islands grew taller. And eventually, some of these rivers even developed waterfalls as the river water poured over cliffs. So that meant for the gobies that as time went along, they had to work harder and harder to reach those little shallow river pools that they liked. It got to the point where these days, and I watched some really cool footage of this on that show, the goby fish, they actually climb up vertical sides rock cliffs of these waterfalls, some of which are more than a football field placed on its end, okay, in order to get to those river pools. And they do this the whole time with the water from the waterfall bashing them in the face. Many of them don't make it, but a lot of them do. Well, how is that possible? Well, the goby fish of Hawaii developed something that no other goby fish in the world have. They developed essentially a second suction cup, their mouth. So here's what happens. After being born, a goby fish spends 5 months in the ocean. And then they head to those freshwater rivers. When they hit the fresh water of the rivers, that triggers a change in them. The mouth of the goby fish moves from being where a normal fish mouth is, like in our picture here, to being on the bottom of its head facing the ground. And that shift happens over just 1 to 2 days. They then are able to use their mouth to climb up the cliff walls of the waterfalls. They inch along, so their bottom suction cup grabs on them. They reach up to the next one, and they just boop, 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 up this cliff. All in an effort to reach those pools that they want to live in. It's amazing, right? Awesome. It's awesome. Well, like any nature show these days, the narrator talks then about the evolutionary development of this mouth sucker that allows these little fish to climb walls. And all of this got me to thinking, and I'm just going to bring you along on my little thought train today, all right? Let's back up for a second and make sure we remember how natural selection works, what scientists tell us. And I am not a scientist, so I might mess this up, but I think I can get us close. So evolutionary scientists would tell us that plants and animals develop through random mutation of genes, right? So something in the DNA replication of an animal actually goes wrong, and it results in that animal or plant displaying a new characteristic or trait. Some of those new traits are not helpful to the animal or the plant, but some of them are helpful. And the theory tells us that the individual animals and plants that develop new helpful traits might be able to survive and reproduce better, more successfully than the others in their species. And therefore, that new genetic trait then gets passed on to that individual's offspring. And this process continues until the animal or plant with the new trait essentially has replaced its less successful ancestors. Right? Well, at first glance, I think it's easy to see how this theory might apply to our goby fish example. Let's just go step by step. So we start out with goby fish who swam into these rivers for the first time, discovered that it was a great place to be, and they survived better than the ones who didn't go into the rivers. Well, somehow then this idea of going into the rivers to live gets implanted in the genetic code of those gobies to the point that soon even all their babies head there after living in the ocean for those 5 months. And I think, don't you have to take a little bit of a leap of faith there as an evolutionary scientist to believe that an idea or a memory of living in a river could get passed through the genes of one generation to the next goby fish? I think there's a leap there, but anyway, I think that's how a scientist might explain it. And then slowly over time, these river pools we saw started to get harder to get to because the island was growing taller due to volcanic activity. Continuing with the possible explanation then, one or more goby fish, the theory would tell us, experience a random mutation that causes their mouths to sit a little bit lower on their face, right? Those fish discover that they can use their slightly lower mouths to help pull them up the new small rock inclines that have formed in the rivers. Those mutated fish make it into the river pools. They survive and reproduce more successfully than the gobies with normal fish mouths, and eventually they take over. So theoretically then, as these islands are slowly growing over many years and the rock inclines are starting to grow taller and more vertical, there are additional random mutations happening in goby fish that cause their mouths to sit even lower, right? And correspondingly, they are the more successful ones at still being able to get to those river pools. And I guess this just continues over and over and over again until the successful fish have mutated so many times that they now have fully developed suction cup mouths that allow them to climb sheer rock faces of substantial lengths. I think that's how an evolutionary scientist would explain it. Something close to that, anyway. I look at Dallas, sorry, our scientist up there. Okay, so I'm sitting there watching this show and thinking about all that. My first thought is that's an awful lot of mutations that have to happen to move a fish's mouth completely into a new spot on its head and give it the ability to perform an entirely new function in addition to eating, suctioning onto a sheer rock face and pulling its body weight up. So that's a lot of random mutating that would have to happen. But, I guess I can see the logic, and I can see the train of thought there, how that would be a possible explanation for this change in the Hawaiian goby fish. But, my mind then goes back to this. Okay, if random mutation over many, many years might be able to explain a slowly shifting mouth where the goby's mouth ends up on the bottom of its head, shouldn't that mouth be in that position its entire life? But it's not. For the first 5 months of its life, it has a normal mouth. And then it goes and hits this fresh water, and in 1 to 2 days, the mouth goes... Broop. How many random mutations do you have to get that? Yeah, I was going to say, it's an incredible amount... Actually, an unbelievable amount of mutations, right? Yeah, that's kind of what I think. It's almost like the goby fish said to itself, it would really be handy if I could have a normal mouth while I'm living out in the ocean. And as soon as I'm ready to go to the river, my mouth shifts down so I can, do that suction cup thing. And then somehow the fish is able to will itself for its body to change like that, Yeah, that would be handy for that fish. It's almost like there was a mind involved in this. Wink, wink. you can say this about so many things in the natural world. We've marveled here in the past about how incredible it is that the monarch butterfly with its tiny little insect brain can somehow find its way from places like Madison, Minnesota, thousands of miles over the air currents to the exact same place that their great-grandparents spent the winter the year before. The butterflies that traveled to that wintering spot in Mexico weren't even the ones who were there last winter. The average monarch lives 6 weeks. So you've got multiple generations going on before the next wintering starts. But somehow, these little bug brains know how to get there. That's a pretty amazing skill for random mutation to create in a little bug. I did a bunch of reading this week on the beauty of peacock feathers and how that might have come about. It's cool stuff, but that one got cut over to your small group study guides for the week. So sorry about that, but you'll see that information there. So for my sermon today, though, I just have one more example for you. And this is going to start out with another video. This video is of a creature that I didn't know existed until this week called the mimic octopus. And people on the radio show, I know that videos aren't terribly helpful for you, but you can hopefully just listen to the narrator here and imagine in your minds what this might look like. Let's watch that that video now.
The mimic octopus. It's a masterly quick-change artist, altering not just its shape, but even its behavior to impersonate a whole range of other creatures. If danger threatens, a menacing color change is no problem. Time to move on. So it alters its shape to imitate a flounder, flattening its body and matching the color of the sand. It undulates low across the bottom, just like a real flounder. Most octopuses are very vulnerable in open water. Usually they hide amongst rocks or corals, and if they have to flee, they dart away behind a cloud of ink. But this mimic has another trick up its sleeve. It alters both shape and behavior to impersonate a fish that swims well above the bottom, a lionfish. Lionfish fins are tipped with venom, so predators learn to avoid them. By its deceit, the octopus shares that protection. Back on the sand, and it's being pestered by an aggressive damselfish. So it imitates something else, a sea snake. Sea snakes are amongst the most poisonous animals on Earth. They use their venom to immobilize their prey, small fishes like damselfish. If all else fails, the mimic octopus can always retreat down its hole.
All right. Pretty cool stuff. Here's another couple of pictures of that octopus doing its thing. So here we are running across the ocean floor, disguised as something. I don't know what it's disguised as there. And then one more. Kind of looks like an owl almost there. So again, I don't know exactly what it's mimicking all the time, but pretty amazing shapes that octopus can change itself into. Okay, so, all right, this is our last example. Let's talk this one through too from, you know, what would evolutionary science say about this? So let's back up and recognize that the mimic octopus does have the traits that the two traits that all octopuses have. One, they can shoot ink out, right? If they're being chased, shoot ink out of their bodies. And also, as was shown in the video, they can change color. Well, I guess evolutionary theory would say that random mutations at some point in the past, probably a series of mutations, it would have to be, over many years, caused the octopus's body to produce this inky substance that it could get rid of as a defense mechanism. And then there's that color change thing. Man, we saw that in the video. It's almost magical how instantly it can change color and then change color back. So, okay, that's a lot of random mutations. to bring that ability about. And then you have to add to that those two things, this mimicking defense, and this seems like an ability of a different sort, because this has to come from thinking, doesn't it? Now, scientists will tell us that octopuses actually are pretty smart, like almost to the level of dogs, maybe. So I suppose, one particular octopus many years ago said to itself, "Man, look at that lionfish. That's one scary dude. You know, I think I might be able to move my arms and twist them up and look like a lionfish. And then maybe everybody else around here would think I was a scary dude. Let's try that. Hey, this is working. What other poisonous creatures could I make myself look like?" Okay? Well, I mean, it has to be something like that, right? So let's say that that was the thinking process. And I'm talking from evolutionary explanation now. Let's say that was the thinking process in the brain of one octopus somewhere along the line. Well, what would explain then all the other octopuses in that family tree displaying the exact same mimicking abilities? Could it be that that one really good thinker octopus survived better than all the others and just reproduced so much that his family, his specific family line, ended up dominating and so forth? But if that's the case, then that would require, again, an idea, so a think, something that was thought up to be passed genetically from generation to generation. Can ideas pass genetically? I don't know about that. So, well, okay, maybe all the other octopuses around the mimicking one saw what he was doing, thought it was a good idea, and just started doing it too. But if it's learned behavior, then wouldn't you think that other species of octopuses who also are smart would have been able to see what these octopuses were doing and also duplicate it? Why is it just this particular species that displays these tricky behaviors? That brings us right back to the thought that this has to do something with genetic programming. Genes that allow for that mimicking idea or skill to get passed down from generation to generation. So we're right back to the same question. How many mutations in an animal do you need to explain that kind of skill? Again, really an unbelievable amount. Almost like there was a mind involved there. Something more substantial, I think, than an octopus mind. Something that could also explain the ink and the color change abilities. And of course, you know where I'm going with all of this. All of these things, the goby fish, the butterflies, the peacock feathers, the abilities of the mimic octopus, all look like a mind was involved there somehow, because there has been and there is a mind involved there. It's the mind of our Creator God. The idea of natural selection has a lot to commend it. There is some stuff that makes sense there, but as an overall explanation of the beauty and diversity of life we see on this planet, as an explanation of the existence of life itself in those matters, it is insufficient. I would argue that in this case, the older idea is actually the correct one, that life on the earth can only be explained by a really big and really amazing Creator God. Diversity, the beauty, the artistry, the function and design, these things are not explainable by a mindless, unconscious evolutionary force. They can only sufficiently be explained as coming from a mind-like, purposeful Creator. And as we said at the beginning of the sermon, just from observing our world, we see also that that Creator is not only able to work on the scale of intricate and tiny, but he also is comfortable working on the scale of mind-blowingly immense. He not only has designed and created one stunning flower on this planet, he's created trillions of them. He's not only created one scorching, hot, burning source of light in the sky, he's created so many of them that I don't even know how to say the number to you. Creation speaks to us, and it tells us that there is a Creator. And that, of course, is exactly what the Bible says, too. And the Bible tells us that this Creator God has contacted humanity many times, but never so fully as in the God-man Jesus Christ. And that Jesus has told me that he knows, that God knows the number of hairs on my head. And after thinking through all of this stuff today, I don't doubt it. God can handle that. And God can handle billions of prayers because this is a God of huge numbers. So, implication of all this, well, I think it's pretty comforting to think that there's a God in heaven who knows the number of hairs on my head, knows my circumstances, knows my hopes and my fears, one who hears my prayers. And that was exactly the point of the teaching from Jesus that we looked at in our short passage for today. Look at it again with me. He said, "Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? Yet not one of them is forgotten by God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are numbered. Don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows." Jesus' point was, take comfort. God knows you. He values you. If you look to him, he'll take care of you. That was the point. Awe and wonder, Calvary. You might feel small and insignificant in this big universe, but this is a God who deals in both the small and the big. Computer told me this week that there are 7 million sparrows in the world, and not one of them is forgotten by God. So, don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. Amen.